Thank you all for coming. And I might as well, I'd like to share my little Lou Rockwell story with you first. My first contact with Lou Rockwell was I was an assistant professor of economics at George Mason University, and I got a postcard in the mail announcing the creation of the Mises Institute. I was very excited about that because I had studied the Austrian school. I used Human Action as a textbook my first semester in graduate school. And so I sent them a small donation. And they sent me a Mises tie, a necktie, with Ludwig von Mises on it. And I wrote Lou and Murray Rothbard, who was the first academic vice president, a thank you letter saying that I will wear the necktie with pride in the halls of academe. And I told them it would have the same effect as flashing a Christian cross in front of Dracula. And that was my first contact with Lou. And then when they started publishing The Free Market, a monthly publication, I started sending them articles. And then they invited me to speak at the conferences. And so I've been associated with them from the very beginning, 42 years. It's hard to believe and all of that. And now my topic today is how court historians turn political villains into heroes. And I'm going to start with a quote from Murray Rothbard in his essay, Anatomy of the State, where he said that in return for power, positions, and money, intellectuals persuade the majority that their government is good, wise, and at least inevitable. This is the vital stock of the intellectuals. The molding of opinion is what the state most desperately needs to retain power. And so I'm going to talk about three people that who Murray called the court historians have written about that creates this image of them as saints, or in the case of Lincoln, a god, as far as a deity, as far as that goes. Alexander Hamilton, Henry Clay, and Lincoln that fit into this. My friend Brian McClanahan wrote a book on Hamilton, and it's called How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America. And he points out that the new hero of the left is Hamilton, because they discovered that he's the real founding father of big government in America. That's why they produced this awful play on Broadway about Hamilton, and they trashed Jefferson, and they love Hamilton. David Brooks wrote in the Wall Street Journal that Hamilton single-handedly, quote, created capitalism all by himself. When I read this, in my home, I have that famous picture of God creating man. You know, there's a finger, there's God's hand, and there's a human hand, God creating man. And David Brooks must think that it's not God's hand, it's Alexander Hamilton's hand. It's creating, you know, the spark to capitalism. Michael Lind wrote a book called Hamilton's Republic, and he was just giddy over the fact that he wrote, Lincoln, both Roosevelts and Lyndon Johnson were all Hamiltonians. You know, yay, Hamilton. When the Brookings Institution, the left-wing Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., when they were preparing for the election of Hillary Clinton, and they produced dozens of articles and several books on a sort of a menu for massive government intervention. And naturally, what do you think they called it? The Hamilton Project. And so McClanahan is right. They discovered the real founding father of big government. And it's interesting when you read these biographies, the official biographies of these people, things that we think would be awful, they think are wonderful. And so if you read, and so they make these people out to be saintly because of these awful ideas. But to them, you know, it's sort of unlimited government. And that's a good thing. So what did Hamilton do? Why does the left love Hamilton all of a sudden so much? Well, he invented the implied powers theory of the Constitution in his debate with Jefferson over a central bank. He said, yes, there's no justification for a central bank in the Constitution, but if you read between the lines of the Constitution, there are implied powers, and a bank would be one of the implied powers. Jefferson responded, in essence, by saying, I've read between the lines and there's just blank space there. But this whole idea of the living Constitution, implied power, came from Hamilton. He praised the sovereignty of the states. He was a sort of a early Confederate states' rights Federalist in the Federalist Papers. And then he spent the rest of his life trying to destroy states' rights. He invented the whole theory that the Constitution was not ratified by the people of the states, it was ratified by the whole people, he said. And he just made that up out of thin air. It's not true at all in any way. He talked George Washington into conscripting 15,000 men to put down the Whiskey Rebellion, which occurred pretty much in the same neighborhood where Ron Paul went to college in western Pennsylvania, near, you know, Washington, Pennsylvania. The farmers of Pennsylvania had been turning grain into alcohol and shipping it across the state to sell. They made more money that way, and they put a special tax on alcohol. So they had a tax protest. Hamilton wanted to hang all the leaders. They rounded them up. They made them walk clear across the state to Harrisburg in the snow. But in the end, George Washington pardoned everybody. But the historians lie about this. You read the books about the Whiskey Rebellion, except for one that I know of. They'll say this proved that the government proved that they have the power to institute any kind of tax that they want. Well, no, it didn't. George Washington pardoned everybody. They didn't execute anybody. They didn't put these people in prison for doing this. So the Whiskey Rebellion succeeded. Jefferson was elected, and he ended these taxes. You know, that's the real story. Hamilton championed 17th century mercantilism as his economic policy. And comically, he called it the American system. Even though it was 17th and 18th century European mercantilism. And so in the American system was protectionist tariffs, what we today call corporate welfare, and a national bank controlled by politicians. It was the British mercantilist system run by Americans. So that's what Hamilton had to say on economics. At the Constitutional Convention, he proposed a permanent president who would appoint all the governors, and the governors would have veto power over all state legislation. So, okay, it's essentially a king. And this is one of the reasons why Jefferson thought that he was a mortal enemy of freedom with ideas like this. When I reread my notes this morning, I wrote in the margin here, can you spell government by executive order? That seems to be, a very Hamiltonian thing, and why, you know, the leftists usually celebrate when Biden or whoever is in that job just signs something, another dictate to us. Hamilton mastered the whole idea of, you know, think of his economic policies, protectionist tariffs, special interest legislation, corporate welfare for selected businesses, special interest legislation, a national bank run by politics, special interest legislation. He had dozens and dozens of phrases that he used for the common good, the public good. I wrote down just some of them. These are Hamilton's words to describe these policies, these special interest policies. Public good, public interest, public weal, public safety, public welfare, public felicity, public happiness, general good, general interest, common interest, national happiness. These are from his speeches. True interests of the community, good of the whole community, and my favorite, common interest of humanity. So higher prices through protectionism are supposed to be the common interest through humanity, according to Alexander Hamilton. He was the first to pervert the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, so that it now has expanded to give government almost unlimited power to regulate almost anything. Originally, the Commerce Clause gave the federal government the right to the ability to regulate free trade between the states. Free trade between the states was the policy. One state can't put a tax, an import tax, on something from another state. And Hamilton made the argument that, well, certainly, a product that crosses states' lines, if the government has the right to regulate that, well, then it also should have the right to regulate what goes on in the production of that product in the first state, you know, where it came from, Okay, it's just you know, just a matter of logic, he said. And so he was the first to concoct a lawyerly argument that would use the Commerce Clause as a way of destroying the true meaning of the Constitution, and in addition to the implied powers. He also made the argument that if the government does something that's unconstitutional, the act of doing it makes it constitutional. How about that? How about that? So if we declare, if we wage war without the consent of Congress, the fact that we did it makes that war constitutional, according to Alexander Hamilton. Now, this had to have been like a trial balloon in his time to see, you know, how far can we go? But we've gone that far. Okay. He praised the central bank, of course. A speech by Ben Bernanke that I read a couple years ago come out and said Alexander Hamilton was the founding father of central banking in America. And of course, coming from Bernanke, he thought that was a great thing. You know, I think it's an odious thing. You know, he put that on his tombstone. And one of my friends, the late Butler Schaefer, once stood above Hamilton's gravestone near the 9/11. It's in the churchyard across the street from the 9/11 site. Hamilton is buried there. And he told me that he stood there for a good 5 minutes to make sure there was no motion, nothing was moving on Hamilton's gravesite. Hamilton's political disciples, Chief Justice John Marshall, Justice Joseph Story, and Hugo Black, another Supreme Court justice, who Brian McClanahan calls FDR's favorite Ku Klux Klansman, it's true, they all cemented these myths into government policy through their decisions on the Supreme Court over the decades. Marshall, some of his opinions were verbatim of Hamilton's speeches, literally, word for word. I've read through them, it was just identical. And he was the Chief Justice for 36 years. So these are the reasons why the left has adopted Hamilton as their new baby. They love Hamilton now. They'll probably produce another corny play. And Hamilton is sort of the founding father of crony capitalism, corporate welfare. And one of my blogs on lewrockwell.com several months ago, I discovered that the guy who produced this bad play on Broadway got $600,000 from the U.S. government in COVID relief money. And so a play about the founding father of corporate welfare gets corporate welfare. How fitting is that? The next example of turning a political villain into a hero is Henry Clay. When Donald Trump made his first speech as president on economics, he went to Lexington, Kentucky, because that's where the Henry Clay's museum is. And Henry Clay picked up the Hamiltonian mantle of the American system. If you were to go online on Amazon and buy a book, a biography of Henry Clay, you'll read all about the American system. But it was Hamilton who coined that phrase, American system. But the policies were the same: protectionism, corporate welfare, national bank. And Clay he picked up that political mantle after the Federalist Party of Hamilton disappeared. And if you were to go into the museum in Lexington, the Henry Clay Museum, you would find a book on display called Henry Clay, the Essential American, by David and Jean Heidler. And it's become sort of the, at least in our day, today, the latest, the biography of Henry Clay, okay? And they say there in the book, he's, quote, commonly regarded as the greatest U.S. senator in history. Well, how many people have you in the room commonly regarded, or never even know anything about Henry Clay as far as that goes? But he was the political son of the American system. And the writer Edgar Lee Masters, in his book on Lincoln the Man, explains that Abraham Lincoln, in turn, was the political son of Henry Clay. Lincoln once said that he got all of his ideas on policy from Henry Clay. He called him the beau ideal of a statesman when he did a eulogy for Henry Clay. So here's what Edgar Lee Masters said about clay, which I and his system, which I think is dead on. It's exactly right. He says, here's Edgar Lee Masters, yeah, Clarence Darrow's law partner, by the way, Edgar Lee Masters. Clay was the champion of that political system which doles out favors to the strong in order to win and keep adherence to the government. His system offered shelter to devious schemes and corrupt enterprises. He was the beloved son of Alexander Hamilton, with his corrupt funding schemes, his superstitions concerning the advantages of public debt, and a people tax to make profits for enterprises that cannot stand alone. His example and his doctrine led to the creation of a party, the Whig Party, that had no platform to announce because its principles were plunder and nothing else. It's probably a good idea if your principle is plunder to keep it quiet. Don't let the public know that's what you're up to. Call it the common good, the public good, the general good of humanity, all that stuff. Okay, and that's Hamilton paved the way for that too. And this, of course, is what attracted a young Abraham Lincoln to the Whig Party. As a young man, he said his goal was to be the DeWitt Clinton of Illinois. DeWitt Clinton was a governor of New York who was notorious for being probably the sleaziest corrupt politician of his era, a real pork barrel politician, machine politician, and that's what Lincoln aspired to be as a young man, but in Illinois. These writers, the Heidlers, in this biography, they say Henry Clay owned slaves and continued to buy them for his whole life. He says, but he was not relentless in pursuing runaway slaves. Now, how they knew how relentless he was, they don't say, okay? But the truth is, Henry Clay did go to court several times to retrieve his runaway slaves, and he proposed legislation in Congress to strengthen the Fugitive Slave Act. And so how can these people write that I wasn't very relentless in pursuing, you know, He did more than any other slave owner in America could have done. He was the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and he wanted a law that would strengthen the Fugitive Slave Act. That's as relentless as you can get, as far as that goes. But then these biographers write that I wasn't very relentless. They write also, quote, he was always ambivalent about owning people, and he hated slavery, but he always owned them. Okay. And my favorite line in his book is that the reason he never freed any of the slaves is he liked farming too much. Like Henry's out there at daybreak walking behind a horse-drawn plow. He likes to be a farmer so much. This is the type of thing, if you get into the biographies by the court historians making saints out of devils, these are the types of things you have to look for. Okay, and you got to read them very carefully sometimes, because they might go on for 50 pages of boring facts, and then there's this that pops up, this sort of thing. He made I'm quoting them again, he made an impassioned speech against continuing slave importations. Well, the economics of that is that Henry Clay owned hundreds of slaves. You reduce the supply of slaves in America, you increase the price of slaves. And so he was increasing the value of his property by wanting to ban the importation of more slaves. So he was not as saintly as they're implying when he said that. He declared slavery to be constitutional. It wasn't, there's nothing in the Constitution. That's why, by the way, Abraham Lincoln boasted in his first inaugural address that a constitutional amendment had just passed the House and the Senate, controlled by the Republican Party at the time, to prohibit the federal government from ever interfering with slavery. It was called the Corwin Amendment. And so here, decades earlier, here's Henry Clay saying it's already constitutional. Well, Lincoln would never have had to say that if it already was constitutional, you know, in the Constitution, and it wasn't. And this reminded me of how, you know, the great Lysander Spooner wrote a whole book called The Unconstitutionality of Slavery, and he was right, and Henry Clay was wrong about that. Henry Clay is praised in this book and all other books about him. He's called the Great Compromiser. Well, to people who believe like us, compromising your principles is not the best thing. best thing. But they praise him. He's a great compromiser. He's great at compromising his principle. What did he compromise about? Well, the one example is the tariff of abominations, the 1828 tariff that increased the average tariff rate to about 50% on imports. It almost caused South Carolina to secede at the time. And the South Carolinians call it the tariff of abominations. And they renegotiated the tariff down over 10 years. And Henry Clay was a part of that. So they call him great because he was a part of the committee that negotiated down the tariff after he sponsored it and created the problem in the first place. Same with the War of 1812. He was the biggest war hawk for the War of 1812. And then after the whole thing blew up in his face, he was on the committee to negotiate the treaty with the British over the War of 1812. And again, he's a great compromiser, but he was as responsible as anybody for the fact that there was a War of 1812. Okay. And they relentlessly badmouthed Clay's biggest critic, John Randolph, the great John Randolph. They call him, these authors call him all kind of names. They call him uncontrollable, a Cassandra, peculiar character, on and on and on. And that's how these things work. But Randolph and Henry Clay had a duel. They fought a duel, and unfortunately, they both missed. But here's a quote from John Randolph about Henry Clay that reminded me of something H.L. Mencken would have said. He said, Henry Clay, he is a man of splendid abilities, but utterly corrupt. He shines and stinks like a rotten mackerel by moonlight. I kind of like that. Okay, I kind of like that. Now, a lot of you are familiar with my writings on Lincoln, so the last example I have here is a Lincoln, and maybe I'll be repetitive to a lot of you because I know a lot of you have already bought my books and all that. But I'll go over some of the things why, you know, Lincoln is he's the big guy in terms of creating turning villains into heroes. So why do they love Lincoln so much? Well, he destroyed the voluntary union of the founding fathers, and placed it with a coerced union held together by bloodshed. By waging a war. He waged war on civilians for 4 years, killing at least 50,000 of them, according to James McPherson, the Princeton Civil War historian. If you standardize for today's population, that would be like the U.S. government murdering 500,000 Americans in 4 years. He supported that constitutional amendment to prohibit the government from ever interfering in slavery. In fact, he was the author of it. Doris Kearns Goodwin, in her biography of Lincoln, cites all the primary sources showing it was Lincoln's idea. And he got William Seward to get this through the Senate. So it came from Abraham Lincoln. And then he lied about it in his first inaugural address by saying, I haven't seen the text of this amendment, but I've heard about it, and I support it. Can you imagine that? A trial lawyer who gets elected president saying, oh, I have no idea what this amendment says, but I'm for it. I'm all for it. So it was a big lie. It was a big lie. He illegally suspended habeas corpus, mass arrested tens of thousands of northern state citizens for merely criticizing him. He took it on himself to redefine treason to mean criticizing him and his administration. And of course, treason, as Ryan said earlier, is levying war upon the states, meaning Virginia, South Carolina, Mississippi, the states. Not something called the United States government in Washington, D.C., the states. And that's exactly what Lincoln did, and therefore he and everyone around him was guilty of treason for doing that. Well, they love Lincoln. I'm running out of time here. He was a lifelong advocate of colonization, or the deportation of all the black people out of the country. Even there's a new book, well, not new anymore, but Colonization After Emancipation, by Philip Magnus, that shows that to his dying day, he and his staff in the White House were counting the number of ships it would take to deport all the black people, even after slavery would be legally ended. Shut down over 300 opposition newspapers in the North, and imprisoned many of the editors and owners. He rigged the 1864 election in a number of ways. So censorship and rigged elections was part of the Lincoln administration. Sound familiar to you? Used slaves as pawns in a war that really he proclaimed had nothing to do with them. He claimed it himself. The official war aims resolution of the United States Congress, the Crittenden-Johnson resolution, clearly stated that the war was about keeping the Union together, and it said very clearly it has nothing to do with what they called the domestic institutions of the states, by which they meant slavery. So they announced to the world that. Lincoln also announced to the world that he said it was his duty to collect the tariffs and imposts, meaning the protectionist tariffs, which had been more than doubled 2 days earlier. And then he said, but beyond that, there would be no invasion of any state. You know, why would a president talk, even use the word invasion of a state, unless he intended it over tax collection? And so that's what he announced in his first inaugural address. If there's going to be a war, it'll be over forcing the southern states to continue sending tax revenue to Washington, D.C. Those are Lincoln's words. I bet you weren't taught that in school, especially if you went to public school, were you? He invoked the first military conscription law, and then he ordered the execution of deserters. He strongly enforced the Fugitive Slave Act during his administration. He ignored the fact that all the rest of the world, including all the northern states, New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, ended slavery peacefully. There was no war anywhere. The British, the French, the Danes, the Dutch, they all had slaves. They all found a way to end it peacefully. The Emancipation Proclamation specifically omitted all of the areas of the country that were in control of the Union Army at the time from the Emancipation Proclamation, including the entire state of West Virginia, which the Lincoln administration illegally orchestrated the secession of. And West Virginia was the last slave state to enter the Union, and it was entered the Union by the works of the Republican Party during the Lincoln administration. They ran the government from Alexandria, Virginia, and it gave the Republican Party two more senators and another congressman. And he raised tariffs 10 times during his and he instituted the first income tax in American history, passed the Legal Tender Acts and the National Currency Acts to monopolize the money supply, and they got the ball rolling finally on massive federally funded corporate welfare with the subsidies to the railroad corporations. Before the war, Lincoln was a wealthy railroad corporation lawyer. He traveled throughout the Midwest in a private train car courtesy of the Illinois Central with an entourage of junior executives. He was offered the job of the general counsel of the New York Central Railroad. That's who he was. If you visit Springfield, Illinois tomorrow and visit his house, it's on a place called Old Aristocracy Row, and it was the biggest house on Old Aristocracy Row. Yes, he grew up in a log cabin, but everybody in the American frontier grew up in a log cabin. And so that was nothing special. People still grow up in log cabins all the time. Some of them are very nice and very expensive. And so that's my time is about run out. And so that's my story, and I'm sticking to it for now about how they turned saints into heroes in the history profession.